from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. As meatpacking plants become coronavirus hotspots, workers fall ill, and large producers dump milk and destroy crops, the nation's industrial food chain is buckling. That's according to journalist and author Michael Pollan, who says the pandemic is exposing glaring deficiencies in the way the United States produces and distributes food. Michael Pollan is Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley and Professor of Practice of Nonfiction at Harvard University. He's written several books on food and agriculture, including In Defense of Food and The Omnivore's Dilemma. And he joins us now to talk about why he thinks it's time to deindustrialize our food system and reimagine the American diet, topics he discusses in his article, The Sickness in Our Food Supply, which appears in the June issue of the New York Review of Books. And welcome back to Forum, Michael Pollan.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to be here.
Always good to have you here. And I think you're the first I remember since Steven Greenblatt, who holds a position at what at least declares itself to be the best public university, UC Berkeley, and the best private university, Harvard.
Not bad.
Always staying busy, I know. And it shows in this article. I mean, there's a lot of research that went into this, and kudos. It's a disturbing article, though. There's some hope in it, and I want to get to that as well. But I'm talking about the article in the New York Review of Books, which really points out how weak the link is in our food chain. This is a food chain which not only makes us more vulnerable in terms of our food supply, but makes us more vulnerable, as you point out, to, well, the coronavirus and things like it. We hope there's not much more like it, but could be.
Yeah, well, you know, this was a surprise to me, too, learning the correlation between poor diet and the greater likelihood of having a bad case of COVID and ending up in the hospital. You know, the diet at the end of the industrial food chain, as we all know, is often called the Western diet. It's characterized by lots of meat, lots of processed food, lots of refined sugars and flours. And it's an inflammatory diet, and it inflames the body. And that can lead to things like type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, which are all now understood as inflammatory conditions. And that seems to predispose people for the most severe cases of COVID. About half of the people who end up in the hospital with bad cases are have either pre-existing hypertension or obesity, and about 30% of them have type 2 diabetes. So these things are linked, and in a way that I think we're just beginning to recognize.
Yeah, and in fact, bringing pre-existing hypertension here to about 48% from the figures I was looking at that you brought out in your article, this is all goes back to what you've been a warrior about, low these many years, food processing and high fructose syrup.
Well, you know, eating real food, you know, I said a long time ago, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. It's a pretty straightforward diet, but in fact, very few of us are eating it. And, you know, the food industry, look, produces lots of attractive products. They're really appealing, at least on the first bite. Food is convenient, inexpensive. You know, how can you complain? Well, you can complain because we know that this is a diet that is contributing to chronic diseases, which, you know, we spend 75% of all our healthcare dollars treating preventable chronic diseases, most of which are linked to diet. So this is a kind of, you know, hidden in plain sight problem. And this is a diet that kills us slowly in ordinary times. It just so happens to kill us very rapidly during this particular pandemic.
Talking again with Michael Pollan, and I'm wondering about something that you point out here, which really struck me, and it has to do with the culpability of the food system as it stands now. You're talking about deficiencies that have been longstanding in production and distribution of food, and you say the story begins during the Reagan administration when the Department of Justice essentially set down different rules on antitrust and enforcement.
Yeah, it was a very kind of, at the time, not a noticed development, but there was a new theory of antitrust that held that we shouldn't get in the way of mergers or consolidation as long as it didn't hurt the consumer. And that became the standard, even though the Sherman Antitrust Act, on which this kind of enforcement is based, never mentions consumers. It wasn't about consumers. It was about undue concentrations of political power. That's why you fought, you know, the meat trust and the banking trust. Under this new theory, if prices were going to come down, there would be greater efficiency. That was the big word everybody was using at the time. Why can you object? And so you loosen up on antitrust enforcement. And it's important to note, this is not a change in law. This is just a memo that some antitrust lawyer wrote at the Justice Department, based on, by the way, a book by Robert Bork. I mean, he was behind this movement that he'd written in 78. And this unleashes a wave of consolidation till the point where we now have only four companies slaughtering 85% of the beef, another four companies slaughtering 57% of the pork. So we have this highly concentrated industry, more concentrated, by the way, than it was in 1920 when we broke up the meat trust. At that point, five companies controlled 80% of the beef. So we've drifted back to a point even worse than where we were at the turn of the last century. And yeah, meat prices have not, you know, have probably gone down over time. But the producers, the ranchers, are really the ones who suffer because they have very few markets for their beef and they become price takers. They basically, the meat packers carve up different regions. So if you're in a given region, if you've got, you know, beef in South Dakota, you don't have a lot of choices. You're going to sell it to whoever is dominating that market and take their price. And you know, again, this worked for the consumer in some ways, but we realized that was a very short-sighted way to look at things. And that efficiency is often in, you know, a reciprocal relationship with resilience. And as you gain efficiency, you lose the kind of redundancy that makes a system resilient. So imagine, you know, if we still had thousands of regional slaughterhouses as we did before 1980 or so, well, any one of them having a COVID outbreak would not even be news. We wouldn't even be talking about it because the system would have this kind of redundancy in it and resilience.
Well, you make the point that the industry allowed this through successive administrations, but what I thought was very telling to bring it up to the present was when you write about John Tyson, the chair of Tyson Foods, putting an ad in the New York Times, and within days, there was a Defense Production Act, which essentially made meat essential, kept the price down, but also put people into a contagion, terrible situation within the meat packs and within the meat packing plants, excuse me. And this is, again, I think, really revelatory of the kind of problem that you're wont to point out in your article. This notion also of the food chain buckling on so many different levels. As I said earlier in the introduction, what's happening to crops and what's happening to milk just being disposed of because the system doesn't work the way it's supposed to be working. But local systems are, you say, more resilient. That's where I think some positive things come in, along with some other things I want to highlight. But talk about that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to look at where the system is breaking down and where it seems to be repairing itself. One of the things I didn't understand about the food system is how bifurcated it has been. We have a kind of retail food chain that delivers food from farms to retail consumers, grocery stores. And then we have this institutional or food service food chain, which is delivering food from a substantially different set of farmers to corporate offices, to schools, to institutions of all kinds. And when people stopped going to work, that food chain collapsed. So that's the food you saw being destroyed. You know, farmers burying giant crops of onions or spilling milk out into the gutter. That milk was being sold in bulk to schools. And the farmers who were selling it couldn't pivot to selling it in smaller containers. They didn't have their own pasteurization equipment. So you have a system that, as it's gotten more consolidated, has gotten much more specialized. So I tell the story in the piece of a farmer who is producing, you know, millions of eggs for the liquefied egg market. These are eggs that, of course, end up in school omelets and scrambled eggs. And he sold all his eggs to Cargill, which dominates that particular market. Well, when that market fell apart and there was no need for eggs in schools under the, you know, shelter at home rules, This farmer did not have the cartons, did not have the grading equipment, did not have the contacts and the contracts to pivot to a retail to grocery stores where eggs were in short supply. So that's an example of how brittle the system is. And that, you know, when you specialize, you do achieve incredible feats of efficiency, but you sacrifice this, you know, this suppleness in the system. And I think that that's what we're seeing on our TV screens, you know, people lining up at food banks for hours in their cars while food is being destroyed in other places. And it's tragic to watch. And it does argue for, you know, organizing the food system on a different basis.
Our guest is Michael Pollan, and his article, The Sickness of Our Food Supply, appears in the June issue of the New York Review of Books. And you can appear on this program, at least audibly, if you would like to join us. I invite you to do that now. Has the pandemic made you think about the food you buy and consume? If you have questions or comments for our guest, please feel free to join us now. You can give us a call. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, join us toll-free at 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum at kqed.org. Another kind of hopeful strain, as opposed to sort of a lot of the grim stuff that you're focusing on here in terms of our food supply. And I think you talk about really the problems that we have become more aware of, making a case for deindustrializing and decentralizing the whole U.S. food system, or a case for a different diet as well. But in the meantime, what we're seeing is also bringing more attention to how utterly dependent we are on essential workers. There's a new way, perhaps, to leverage after this crisis for more wages, for more benefits, health benefits, for really more protections for our essential healthcare workers. And I think this is a point that really bears a great deal of emphasis and is tied with your sense of hope, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I do see the potential for to craft a new politics coming out of this pandemic, or even during this pandemic. We have been acquainted with this new concept of the essential worker. This is a phrase you didn't hear before, because these workers were people at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale. Food workers are some of the lowest paid workers that there are, and they're treated as essentially disposable and interchangeable. Suddenly they're heroes because they are keeping the wheels from flying off our society by continuing to deliver food to us and continuing to pick the food and slaughter the animals and cut up the animals. And so there's this paradox of how could essential workers be treated so badly? And I think there's a growing recognition that when those people have sick pay and health care, we all benefit. And that the zero-sum approach we've taken to benefits like healthcare or sick leave, you know, should be universalized from the most selfish point of view, because we want these people to be healthy. We depend on them. And so a politics that essentially would give them the sort of compensation, respect, and benefits and healthcare that would more truly reflect their importance to society seems to me a kind of winning political message right now.
Talking about a social safety net, really, that would go directly to public health as a matter of national security, aren't you?
Well, exactly. I mean, we understand now that public health is a matter of national security, and we need to start treating it that way. And that the whole idea of tying your health insurance to your employment suddenly doesn't seem so smart as everybody's losing their jobs. And that it is a definitely something that the social safety net holds us all up. And so I do see some opportunities here politically. And on the antitrust front, look, it's very important to understand that the food system we have is not the kind of natural product of the free market. Ever since the Depression, when we first started having agricultural policies and antitrust policies, the food system has been the result of political choices. One is to allow these companies to merge willy-nilly. And another is to support farmers who grow commodity crops more than we support farm. Commodity crops are things like corn and soy that are, you know, not exactly food, but at the basis of the industrial food chain, and not do very much for farmers growing real food that people can eat that is correlated with healthy outcomes. So it's a time, I think, to re-examine all of that and also re-examine the sheer power of these companies. You mentioned the Tyson episode and that ad he took out. I mean, essentially, he was threatening the president with a meat shortage, which Trump immediately understood as a threat to his base. I mean, no political leaders likes to see meat shortages, right? This costs you a lot.
Forgive me, Michael. This is a political leader who understands feeding the base raw meat, too.
Yeah. He does indeed. And within 2 days of that ad, he invokes the Defense Production Act, declaring, and listen to this absurdity, that meat is a scarce and critical material essential to the national defense. Now, we got through World War II, you know, with very little meat. we rationed meat at the time. And what this tells me is that this company, Tyson, or this small group of meat packers has so much power that they can force a president's hands to in turn force their workers who are frightened about getting infected back onto the line. That's too much power for a corporation to have.
And we've got lots of callers. Let's get to as many of you as we can. We'll start with Joshua in Sebastopol. Joshua, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having Michael Pollan on. Thank you, Michael Pollan, for your, you know, candor and talking about this issue. My question was about, you know, how do we create an industrial food system that can tolerate these kinds of business conditions? And it was you basically just talked about it, which is that this is not an industry that has just popped up to meet the market's needs. Is a result of political, you know, machines. And maybe those political machines could be a little bit strong. I mean, you basically just said that they got strong-armed by the board of meat guys. But what options are there for our political machine to maybe rein these guys in or make these essential workers feel like they're paid essentially?
And Joshua, are you a farmer? Do I have that right?
No. I teach high school.
Oh, I thought you were a farmer. I'm sorry. Michael Pollan, can you respond to
that? Yeah, well, I think the first step is go back and dig out that memo in the bowels of the Justice Department written in 1981 and rewrite it. I think Elizabeth Warren, if she were president or vice president, would do that pretty quickly. I think she clearly understands this issue and this problem and rethink the standards for allowing companies to merge and break up ones that have gotten too big for their own good and for our own good. That's one step. The other is reorganize your farm policies, which right now are designed to encourage maximum production of calories, regardless of their quality. In other words, maximum production of corn and soy, and devise incentives that prioritize the production of high quality, healthy calories, and organize your food policy around health. Both health of the land and health of the population. That's what the farm bill should be. That should be the screen through which we evaluate every chapter in the farm bill.
Let me thank Joshua for the call. I think it's our next caller who's a farmer, also calling from Sebastopol. Ryan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I run New Family Farm in Sebastopol. We're about 12 acres of organic vegetables. And we've had to cut our crop plan by 75%, a couple hundred thousand dollars. We can't provide jobs to workers that last year we could. And we're a small local scale farm. However, our market is not resilient because of the same issues you described. Yeah, restaurants and institutional buyers like the tech companies actually in the Bay. Right. Through like a small scale food hub called Feed Sonoma, which is doing some of the most important work in the food system in the country right now. And the reason from 10 years in farming and working with kitchen table advisors and Feed Sonoma, the problem I see is that there's an invisible wall between small farms and grocery stores that are just right down the road. And it's a wall made out of bureaucratic hoops. And that really, like, access to market so that we can actually shift in times of a pandemic or other disasters shift our market is what we need to actually create resilience in the food system, especially one that's decentralized, made up of small-scale producers like us.
Yeah, Ryan, thank you for that. What about shifting markets, Michael Pollan?
Well, I think that that is an enormous challenge. You know, the least glamorous corner of the whole food system is distribution, but in many ways, it's the most important. And over the years, this distribution system has gotten very specialized, and that your local grocery store wouldn't know how to buy from a farmer. And it is using, you know, giant distributors who will only buy huge quantities. So it has been a challenge for small farmers like the caller to transition. And some of them, especially the ones who relied on restaurants, which, you know, the farm to table movement was a real thing, and it supported thousands of farms around this country. And as you know, restaurant meals disappeared. Some farmers have pivoted by moving to a box scheme, a CSA scheme. And I know I get a box every week from farmers that used to supply a restaurant in my neighborhood. And those farmers have, with the help of that restaurant, have been able to pivot. Some farmers, though, are basically growing more food than they can in that market, for that market, or they just don't have the infrastructure. They need a website. They need help designing that. They need the labor to pack those boxes and retrieve those boxes. And so, you know, when I talk to small farmers, the two things they talk about is they need the business skills and resources to pivot to a consumer market, and they need help harvesting crops, because there's a real concern that this summer there won't be enough hands to harvest the crops. You know, these are workers just like the meat plant workers who are very vulnerable in our society, often undocumented, living in very close quarters on farms, working very close to one another, even though they're outdoors, and that there may not be enough hands to pick the crops. And that may lead to very severe, I'm really worried about shortages in the fall happening because of this.
What about size, though, Michael? I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, you got these two separate food chains, and retail farmers go to grocery stores. Let's say they're taking a product there. They can only take a certain amount of that product, as opposed to much larger amounts of the product that they can go to institutional places like restaurants or corporate offices or schools for that.
Yeah, or they can, you know, start selling to canneries and people who are processing tomatoes, for example. There are a lot of different markets, and the appetite for the food is there. It's really just this system has gotten so specialized that it can't, you know, it's not nimble. And we have to figure out a way to restore some agility to the system.
Move those silos, huh?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah, and that may mean, you know, coming up with new distribution schemes. Food hubs that the caller mentioned is a really good idea. So we need some innovation here, without question. And it's happening. There's some very encouraging things happening around the country with local food. And there is, people are figuring it out. People are going to farms and picking up food there. And so the demand is there, and the food is coming off the farm still. And, we just need to figure it out, and we need some help from the Department of Agriculture. Now, they have done taken some steps to get some of this food that is being destroyed and send it to food banks. And I applaud the USDA for doing that. And Governor Cuomo has been doing that in New York also, when he saw footage of milk being poured out on the ground.
Boy, we need a lot more of that, don't we?
We do. And that's what the Defense Production Act should be used for taking control of this system and fixing and providing this kind of flexibility, not to just keep meat plants going so Tyson can profit.
And let me bring out another caller. Kat joins us from San Luis Obispo. Kat, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me. I actually work for the San Luis Obispo Food Bank. I help run our food rescue program, and it's been a particularly interesting time to be in this field. And Michael, you're one of my heroes and have informed my entire education and career, so I just wanted to thank you personally. But my question has to do with how a deindustrialization of our food system could work in places where food doesn't grow abundantly. It's so easy for me in San Luis Obispo to see how my community could live on only the produce that we grow within the confines of our county, even though 97% of that gets shipped to the Bay or down to LA or across the country. But I'm really interested in how this could, how a local food system could work in a place where food doesn't grow.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I don't think we're talking about moving to a point where we don't have national distribution. You know, I think the people on the East Coast are not willing to give up all that winter produce they get from, you know, Yuma City, Arizona, or where you are. But I think it's just about having more than one food system and layering them so that it works at each scale. And that means some, you know, support. I mean, look, we spend tens of billions of dollars supporting the food chain through Department of Agriculture policies. The Department of Agriculture spending helped build farmers markets, for example. We need more money to encourage these local systems, and we can assume Sysco will take care of the national, moving the food around nationally and the other big companies. But we just have to, you know, not put all our eggs in one basket. We need to create a lot of baskets.
And we're talking with Michael Pollan. I want to remind you that his article, The Sickness in Our Food Supply, appears in the June issue of the New York Review of Books. Kathleen writes, would you please speak about the dangers of infections that jump from animals to humans and keeping large numbers of animals in a small space? Michael Pollan?
Well, you know, many infectious diseases over the years come from animals and close proximity. The ones we're used to, you know, things like measles and chickenpox and all sorts, had to do when we started farming animals and settling down rather than moving around. And then we have extreme cases right now of wild animals that we live in close proximity to because of what we're doing to the environment. So this is, in a way, an ecological story. Pandemics are ecological stories. And, you know, we believe that this particular virus was conveyed from a bat to a human. I don't know that that bat was a food source. There may have been an intermediate animal. Nobody's really kind of pinned this down entirely. But as the wild is intruded upon by development, by deforestation, these animals come. I mean, we know this from, you know, walking around our city streets where we now see deer.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Michael. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but always good to have you. And I appreciate very much you being with us. Thank you. Carry on. Onward and upward.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael Pollan. And again, his article, The Sickness in Our Food Supply, is in the June issue of the New York Review of Books. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.